Hello, everyone. My name is Tara Montazeri. I am a registered associate marriage and family therapist, and you are listening to Trust and Thrive. On this show, we will discuss topics related to mental health, relationships, generational healing, systemic issues, and other topics that influence us in our everyday lives. Although the show is not a replacement for therapy, I hope the conversations shared can inspire you to stay curious, to self-reflect and practice self-compassion, and to find support in community. You can follow along on Instagram at Trust and Thrive, and stay tuned for new episodes released every Thrive Thursday. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you enjoy the show. Now let's get right into this week's episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the show. This week, I decided to do a revisit of one of the past episodes, which is actually the most listened to episode ever of Trust and Thrive. So this episode is one that was recorded in 2020. So once again, I understand that my views and even the way I speak and the questions may sound very different than how it is now. And I have not necessarily listened back recently. Usually I would feel weird about resharing past episodes if I feel like I may have grown in certain ways. But I do believe that this guest, Mandy Salegari, is so vulnerable and shares such incredible insight. She is a therapist, she is an author, and we discuss the topics of reparenting, self-esteem, understanding addiction, and so much more. And as always, please remember that this show is not a replacement for therapy. There's no one-size-fits-all answer, and every episode is complex. So please remember that. And I will include all of Mandy's info in the show notes if you want to learn more about her work. So thank you for being here. I am very thankful to Mandy. This was a great episode, and I hope you enjoy. So let's get right into the episode with Mandy. Hi, Mandy. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Can you start off telling us a little more about yourself and what it is that you do?
Yes. So I work as a therapist in mental health. I am in London. I work in Harley Street. And I started by working with addiction, really. But then I began to understand addiction in a much broader sense. And I've expanded into working into early intervention. I work with couples, families, individuals. And probably the most work I do is with families and with groups.
Amazing. And so can you tell us a little more about your book, Proactive Parenting, and what inspired you to write it?
Well, as a result of the work that I do, and some of the work I do, I go into schools and talk about, part of the intervention and prevention work is to go into schools and talk about everything that happens and what you have to do when you run into difficulty. So I started to develop a model of care that I could teach to students, teachers, and their parents in order to look out for problems nice and early on and take evasive action, if you like. Do the right thing at that moment to avoid running into real difficulty later. And as a result, lots of people asked me if I'd written a book. And eventually, I settled down and thought, right, I really need to get this model down on the page, because otherwise I spend so much time explaining this part of the work that when somebody comes to see me, it takes a couple of sessions to get into their own story, because I'm describing the framework. So it's a shortcut really for me, so that when people come and see me, we can hit the ground running.
And what have you noticed with your work? Have you noticed that addiction lies with deeper issues? And how can one start to explore those wounds if they've never done so before?
Well, the thing about addiction is people automatically say, what were you addicted to? Which is the wrong question, actually. The right question is, what happened in your life that was so painful? Actually, what happened in your life that you would employ something outside of yourself to do the emotional job for you instead of dealing with it yourself? Because addiction is using something in an attempt to fix how you feel to the detriment of yourself. So it's not about the drugs or the alcohol or the gambling or anything like that. Addiction is the desire to self-medicate because you don't trust your own ability to mend yourself or to cope. So when I think about addiction and what we're looking for, you're looking for somebody's inability or perception that they can't cope with how they feel or what's going on for themselves. So they end up delegating that emotional process onto something else. In other words, somebody might think they're funnier if they drink, or they might think that they can't stand sitting around doing nothing because it makes them feel anxious. So they end up tidying the house all the time or having to make things absolutely perfect. Or maybe somebody feels really low. So what they do is they overeat and then make themselves sick. The things that you do, you have to get into abeyance. Obviously, you can't eat and make yourself sick. But the real work is to attend to the fear of being bored, to attend to how you might feel about yourself. That means you can't cope with feeling sad or don't know how to be angry. These are the real focuses, or should be the real focus of any successful therapeutic intervention on addiction.
Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you brought that image of the broad range of what addiction can look like. And so for someone who may not even know that they're addicted to something, because it isn't always alcohol or drugs, you know, it could be your phone, like you said, it could be food. How can one start to notice that it is an addiction?
Well, I think that addiction and dependence are very close. So when you feel compelled to do something, even though you know it's not good for you, so you'll start negotiating with yourself. So you might be on your phone or something and think, I know I need to turn it off or put it down to go to bed or to go and do something else. And then in your head, you start negotiating. I'll do it in 10 minutes so I can do that other thing tomorrow. It doesn't matter. And you start reorganizing your commitments and your life in order to fit in with the kind of compulsive activity. What's likely to be going on there is that there's another feeling kicking around underneath that means that you're neglecting yourself or neglecting that need. So the first thing to do is to address whatever that compulsion is, whether that's drinking, taking drugs, gambling, overeating, using your phone, overexercising, all of those kinds of things. And I think there are 15 of those, by the way. And to put a boundary around it and absolutely stick to what you have decided you are or aren't going to do at whatever time. And then notice the kinds of feelings that come up as a result of making yourself abstinent. So, for example, if you say to yourself, I'm going to go out next weekend and I'm not going to drink. And then somebody says, oh, come on, it's going to be a really good party. Come out, drink, do your non-drinking thing the next weekend. Oh, come on, it's so much fun when we go out and just have a couple. You don't have to drink that much. Come on. And you get all of that negotiating going on. You need to be stopping and thinking, no, I said I wasn't going to drink. I'm not going to drink. And now I need to deal with the feelings that come up, the feelings of not being good enough, the feelings that I'll be boring, or I'll feel vulnerable, or I'll feel self-conscious if I don't drink, or that my friend wants me to drink, so I'll be left out if I don't. And try and consider how powerful, actually, those thoughts are that might then determine whether you drink or not. And if you struggle to cope with those feelings, try and go and see someone to work it through, because the likelihood is they have their origins in early childhood experience.
Mm-hmm. And so I know you talk a lot about early childhood experience, and I really loved your TED Talk. That's how I found you, and it really stuck with me because I think we all can relate to that. And so what are your thoughts on the roles that we played growing up and who we were in the eyes of our parents or our guardians? How does that affect how we grow up and the thoughts we have about ourselves?
Well, I think what happens is that, well, I know what happens is that the family, the childhood that we grow up in is a bit like the greenhouse that we're in. So everything that happens to us and around us, everything that we see and experience shapes us. So it's not blaming a parent or a sibling for who we are. It's trying to be curious about the ingredients that were present that went into making us the way that we are. And the likelihood is that we will look at same gender parent or older sibling as a kind of example of what it is to be a man or a woman. And we look at opposite gender for what we experience as how the world will receive us. It's quite a complicated framework to explain in a nutshell. But the point of it is that as we grow up, we look around us for examples of who and how to be. We see a parent being angry, we feel frightened or embarrassed. And inside, we might say to ourselves, I don't want to be anything like that parent, so I'm not going to be angry. So as a result, we repress anger, which then comes out sideways in the form of controlling behavior or anxiety or depression, when actually what it is a warped and fear-based experience of anger that needs addressing. So I ask people to simply be detectives around their own childhoods, really try to think of adjectives to describe parents, atmosphere at home, the sorts of things that you saw and felt, so that you can start to gather the evidence to explain to you why you react in certain ways around certain influences in adulthood. Because once you're aware of those influences, then you can go about changing them if you wish.
Mm-hmm. And would you consider that to be reparenting? And do you think a tool is to speak with your inner child?
Absolutely. I do think it's about reparenting. So the book that I wrote, which is Proactive Parenting, isn't just for parents of children. It's for yourself as a parent of your own inner little person. However old that person is, by the way, they can be an inner teenager stomping around, causing a right load of trouble. But you need to be able to parent that part of yourself so that you listen and you contain and you take responsibility for your subsequent behavior. So yes, I think reparenting yourself almost squares the circle of the effective relationship with yourself, because ultimately we're all responsible for ourselves and we are the common denominators in everything that happens in our lives. There's no getting away from it.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some examples of reparenting for someone who doesn't necessarily know what that is? Would you say it's positive self-talk, or what are some ways someone can do that?
I think positive self-talk is really difficult. And I think what it can do is create a surface expectation that you're supposed to feel better when actually you don't. I'm a believer in action, actually putting action into your life. So maybe look at your day. The day before, look at tomorrow. And if you have somebody in your life that you can trust to be objective and supportive, even better, because sometimes left to our own devices, we really don't serve ourselves well. But I think I would look at drawing up a day for myself, and then I try to follow exactly what's in my plan. So I will look ahead at my day and put things in and not put things in, and I will do just what I prescribe for myself, which includes getting up at a certain time, having time to eat, making sure that I'm sort of washed and dressed and so on, and also that I've had time to gather myself, either through a moment of self-reflection or meditation, so that when I step out of my front door and into the world, I've gathered myself, I'm in my skin. And then to eat three times a day, to laugh during the day, to achieve something in your day, to say yes and no appropriately to whatever turns up in your day, so that you don't oversubscribe yourself through people-pleasing, but also so that you say yes to opportunities so you don't isolate. And I think good self-care is about, and therefore parenting yourself, is about exactly that. It's about making sure I sleep enough, eat enough, rest enough, play enough, and am productive enough for each day that I have.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that's what inspired you to write Proactive Parenting? Like, how would you define proactive parenting for someone who doesn't know what that is?
Proactive parenting is recognizing that in our own lives and in the lives of our children, we have influence. There's no denying it. We have influence. And proactive parenting is saying that I want to accept that I have influence, and I want to be as mindful and as conscious as possible around what that influence is. It's not that it always has to be great, but it is that I have to be honest about what that is and where I am in that relationship, either with myself and my own expectations of myself and how hard I am on myself or whatever that might be, or with my own children and my expectations that I think they should be or are capable of so much more than they're able to deliver on a daily basis. I need to recognize that that's my stuff, a great clinical term. Proactive parenting says take responsibility for that and become aware of who and what you are and what those influences are so that you can be in relationship with yourself or your child without denial.
And I think that's so important. I think a lot of people repeat generational patterns and they project their childhood wounds onto their children, or they don't even realize they're doing so. And so would you agree that it is so important to reflect on these wounds and these limiting beliefs we grew up with so that we don't pass these down?
I think more than that, I don't, as a therapist, I always think that people often say things like, gosh, the world is full of misery and therefore I've got lots of clients as a therapist. Or you go into a therapist to talk about wounds and self-limiting beliefs and all the negatives. I actually think that people turn up for therapy out of hope, not despair. They turn up because, and when I came into therapy, I certainly turned up because I felt that I was worth more than the way I was living my life. And I felt that somebody out there must be able to help me. And that is an act of self-worth and it's an act of hope. So I think that self-reflection isn't just on the wounds and the self-limiting beliefs and those things. I think self-reflection is about all of who I am, being really curious about the interplay between the positive, the negative, the passive, and the assertive, to really have a look at what the ingredients are that make you up, to be the complex being that you are in the lives of, for example, your children, so that you can make sense of yourself, and then your messages will be clearer, they'll be congruent, your children will know you, and therefore they will be able to work out what is them and what is you. And that, I think, is the gift we give. Yes, we can attempt to heal our childhood wounds and the kind of negative messages that we pick up. And I say attempt because sometimes you can't heal all of it, but I think you can forgive yourself for having those wounds, if you like, and for not being perfect. But I think you must also bank the good stuff. You must also acknowledge the good stuff that you bring with you and not just make your attentional bias in self-reflection or in therapy to be about the negative.
Definitely. And with that said, what would you say to someone who maybe feels shame around feeling this way or maybe being addicted to something? Like, what would you tell them if they feel embarrassed?
Oh, gosh, everybody. I think everybody feels embarrassed about their vulnerabilities and their flaws, certainly to start with. But I think the simple fact is, if you reflect on the people you feel closest to, they're probably the people who know those flaws. And I think that we connect through our troubles. We connect through our vulnerabilities. That's where some of the most profound intimacy and connection evolves out of. So why would we defend against it? I think if we're embarrassed by our mistakes and our, you know, flaws and the problems that we have, then there's some kind of internal message that says we shouldn't have them. Whereas most of the time, somebody's negative presenting symptom, if you like, has got a very clear trail back to an originating stimulus. So it makes perfect sense that somebody would be that way. And to deny that is to deny the evidence that might allow you to get better. People coming in is very exciting. I absolutely love it when somebody has the courage to open their mouth and say, do you know what? I'm struggling with this. I have a great affection for that process.
And so for someone who didn't grow up in an environment where they were encouraged to work through their feelings and express their emotions and they don't even know where to start, what advice would you give to them?
Okay, I think a couple of things. One is, I think, get yourself a little book that you can pop in your pocket and carry with you throughout the day, and start jotting down the kinds of emotions that you have through the day. Play detective with yourself. Make yourself your own best project. And that's not to encourage utter self-centeredness and navel-gazing just for the sake of it. It's to say that if you really get interested in you and learn how to take care of you, then you will be able to afford to be generous. The ultimate point is to connect and be other-centered as part of this process. So I think get a notebook, jot down your feelings, just the odd emotion as it happens to you during the day. Start to notice the behaviors that follow. And if you struggle with addictions, whether they are, you know, your classic drug, alcohol addictions, whether they're sex and love addictions, so that you really struggle in relationships, whether you're a compulsive caretaker or a compulsive eater or a compulsive exercise or a compulsive worker or gambler, all of those patterns have got anonymous fellowship meetings where people can go along and just listen to other people's processes and hear a pathway into recovery, which requires you to make a commitment to be abstinent so that you can start to work on your emotional process. So what I'd encourage anyone to do who struggles with an addictive process, I encourage people to go to the fellowships. There's a fellowship for many, many different addictive patterns. And in the States, you are prolific with your fellowship, anonymous fellowship meetings, which I'm a huge fan of because they are free. They are not judgmental and you can just turn up and you can listen. And what they require you to do is to be abstinent from your acting out behavior so that you can access a huge amount of support and fellowship in those rooms to help you to start working through your feelings. Other than that, and your history, if you like, of difficulties with other people who are doing the same thing, another way of doing it is jotting down your feelings throughout the day, starting to notice your subsequent behaviors. So if you realize that you feel a bit unhappy and resentful, notice that then you start thinking about drinking or overeating or isolating. Recognize the link between feelings and behaviors and proactively start to write down things you feel grateful for, not just the big things like health and family and friends, but things like, I don't know, clean sheets or the color of your socks or the, you know, the bright blue sky. Start to notice the little things and write them down, because recovery is an attitude of gratitude and we have to work hard to achieve that. I'm an addict in recovery and I know how hard it is to pull yourself out of a negative spiral and pattern of behavior and to carve out a different way of living for yourself. But I can promise you it's possible. And the greatest affirmation that I like and I suggest to people I work with isn't necessarily imposing upon yourself, I don't know, looking for something good about yourself to say to yourself. All you need to say as you brush your teeth and look in the mirror as you're brushing your teeth is to say to yourself, I'm looking forward to spending the day with you today and seeing what comes up. You in? You on with me? And at the end of the day, when you're brushing your teeth, say, I hope that went well, or I enjoyed my day, or, you know, thanks for today, or gosh, weren't we brave when we said to that person how we felt when they asked us. Start to build up a relationship with yourself, because once you have a loving relationship with yourself, you will never feel the depth of loneliness that you will feel when you don't.
I love that. And so I want to ask you, this whole show is about living your most authentic life, and I love asking guests this question because everyone has such a different answer. So what does living your most authentic life mean to you?
Living my most authentic life, it means that my commitment is to represent myself with dignity and respect so that the very least I can give is for you to know who I am and where I am in my life with you. I don't play games, I won't lie, and I try really hard not to manipulate outcomes, so that the simplicity of just how it is and the company of just being with you, it's stopping manipulating anything and just living with the simplicity of what actually is, which means that you can just relax into the company of another person and feel that connection without any expectation, past or future. And I find that peaceful. And I'm very grateful for it.
Mm-hmm. And so I want to lastly ask you, where can listeners give you a follow and what's coming up next for you and your work?
So I am, what am I doing? Yes, so I'm on Instagram. I'm at Mandy Saligari on Instagram and on Twitter. I've also got a Facebook page for my company, Charter Harley Street, which is a clinic in London. I am beginning to consider a second book, but there's some television work which will be coming out next year. But mostly I am fully invested in my clinical practice and working with people who want to change their lives. So thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Mandy.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, you can find me on Instagram and TikTok at Trust and Thrive, and I will include Mandy's info in the show notes along with her book if you would like to learn more about her work. I hope you all have a wonderful rest of your week, and we will be back with a new episode next Thrive Thursday.